Good morning.
Good morning.
Very nice to see all of you again this morning. I have a fun visitor sitting here in the front row. My daughter Kim came up and surprised me last night. Listen to this. I had no idea she was coming. And of course, I was very excited to hear Tad, and I thought I could say to you all this morning, let's talk about Tad, you know, like a true mother, you know. And so then Marna told me that we were going to be sitting close to the front, and I told her I'd, you know, just look for her, obviously. And so she, as I'm coming down, I spot Marna because of the nice long blonde hair, and I see her talking to someone. And you know, when you're not ready to see someone, you just don't see them. So I saw her talking to someone, but as I'm walking down the hall, then I kind of glance to see who the someone is. And it's like, oh my goodness, it's Kim, you know? So it was a very, very nice surprise. She has often said that she would love to be here on a Thursday morning. And it's great fun to have you here, honey. I am very proud of my kids, in a good way, of course. I mean, we have to be careful with our words now that we're going through this. In 1 Corinthians 13, and I just can't get away from reading the introduction, because I have an idea that, you know, maybe you'll sit here several weeks in a row and hear me read it, and nothing will particularly touch you in it. But I also believe, just knowing how the Holy Spirit does speak to us, that there will be times when I read it, and maybe something that went right past you last week is going to bring conviction this week. So I will start out in verse 1. If I speak in the tongues of men and of angels, but have not love, I am only a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have the gift of prophecy and can fathom all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have a faith that can move mountains but have not love, I am nothing. If I give all I possess to the poor and surrender my body to the flames but have not love, again, nothing. Love is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy, it does not boast, it is not proud. And last week, as I told you a while back, you know, I mean, I've had, none of these teachings are prepared, so I don't know where I'm going from week to week. But when I had read this, I remembered thinking, oh, you know, maybe I can do the envy, boast, proud, you know, all the things that love is not. Maybe I can kind of put all of those together. Because I truly, I mean, when I started thinking, and this is before I was, you know, really doing anything. I mean, it was the week before last, about envy. It was like envy. You know, like I had no idea what I would say about envy. And so then last week, when after I had done this teaching, and I thought, well, I mean, should I do just envy? You know, we'll see. And so I just prayed. And again, I don't want you to think, you know, oh, picturing me on my face, you know, on the carpet, you know, praying, you know. I'm in my kitchen pouring the water for my tea, you know, and I'm just saying to the Lord, you know, please, if you want me to do envy by itself, would you just, you know, show me what you would have. I mean, Lord, I have no idea what you would have me say about envy. And if you would just give me just an illustration to get me going, that would be such a help. And boom. I mean, it wasn't 1 minute later. It wasn't 15 seconds later. It was that very, very moment. And the Lord gave me an example, and then I knew without a doubt that's where he wanted me to go. But what I didn't know was that he would give me so much to say on envy. You know, envy is very similar to jealousy. And we've all heard it called, you know, that green-eyed monster. And it is a monster. And the enemy loves to use this tool with men and women. But I feel women are particularly susceptible to envy. You know, seeing what someone else has, seeing what someone else does, seeing how someone else looks, seeing how someone else dresses. It goes on and on and on. And in endless ways. And the enemy loves to use it with women as one of his favorite tools. And I got to thinking about why. And I was actually surprised at what I feel the Lord showed me. The reason the enemy loves to use it is because it steals contentment. It's impossible to be content and to be envious too. Impossible. And you've all experienced it. You know, you might be going somewhere and feeling good and all's well, and you see something that it sets you amiss because you want that too. Or, you know, whatever. But the terrible thing about envy too is basically it makes us complain to God, whether we, you know, we may not think that. We may be complaining to a friend or family member, to your husband. You might be complaining. But what you remember when the Israelites complained in the desert, you know, they were complaining, who, to Moses, right? Complain, complain, murmur, murmur, murmur. And what did God say? That they were complaining to him. So that's the part that we really need to reckon with, is that when we are complaining, even though we may be directing the words to a person here, the truth is we're complaining to God. And essentially what we're saying to him is, you're not doing this right, you know, or somehow this isn't fair, this is wrong. And again, I think it's important for us to see it in that light in order to not do it, to stop it. We'll always be tempted to. The reminder, you know, the enemy tempts us. The temptation in itself is not the sin. Always remember that. So we're always going to be tempted. I don't think we'll ever be beyond being tempted by envy. The temptation, that's just the little ploy of the enemy. But our responsibility will be to squelch it, stop on it, then and there, not give it any thought life up here, to stop it. Because to entertain it, let alone harbor it, is sin. And so be ruthless with yourself about it. So the Lord actually gave me three, or actually we could say four, different stories for illustrations. And they're all showing different aspects of envy. And yet it was interesting because they all have a common denominator, which I thought was interesting, and that is position. And I'm not even going to share with you my alliteration because it wasn't good. But, I mean, because truly, I mean, I loved when you hear a teacher use alliteration because it helps you to remember, you know. And I came up with different ones, but I decided this morning, don't even go there, Judy. But I can say that they all had, and that's what tempted me to go on with it. They all have the common denominator of position, but it's just how and what it's linked to. So that morning in the kitchen, the story that, I mean, and that's why I really, really knew it was the Lord, when I said to him, you know, please just give me an illustration. I immediately heard Mephibosheth and Ziba. Now, I know that was the Lord because I don't think of Mephibosheth very often, you know. I didn't even know I remembered the name Ziba, you know. But soon as I heard that, it was like, okay, Lord, I know that's what you want me to do. And what I've done is I've tried to type out a lot of the scriptures so that I'm not going back and forth. But at the same time, this story is such that I really felt there were some things where I just have to read the whole chapter. So it may take a little bit more time, but I just have to do it in order for you to really get the story. Now, I'm sure you know who Mephibosheth was, but in case there's anyone here who doesn't, he was Jonathan's son. And you remember the incredible friendship that David and Jonathan had. Jonathan was Saul's son. And the truth is, Jonathan actually could have been envious of David if he was given to envy, because he was theoretically going to squelch the opportunity that Jonathan should have had to be next in line to be king. But Jonathan had none of that. Jonathan loved David. David said after Jonathan died that, you know, that he and Jonathan had a friendship that was unlike any other. He said, even better than the love of a woman. That was the kind of friendship he had with Jonathan. How incredible that was. There was a story where they made a covenant to each other that their friendship would always, you know, be there, that they would do well toward each other. And so this is a story that takes place. This is when we hear about Mephibosheth the first time, and it's after Jonathan and Saul were killed when they were fighting the Philistines. And it says in 2 Samuel 4, I'll tell you that just in case you want to jot it down, you can look it up later, but it just makes a little kind of a parenthetical story, a little introducing him. And it just said that at the time that Saul and Jonathan were killed, when the word got out, the people who were in the king's palace and his estate, feared for their lives. They felt that they had to flee. And so Mephibosheth was 5 years old. His nurse grabs him to carry him and run. And unfortunately, she drops him. And, you know, I thought, how interesting, because who knows what happened? Did he break his ankles? You know, what happened? But there was no fixing in that time, you know. And the point is, it says he was dropped, and ever after that, he was crippled in both feet. And that's the only little reference it makes until chapter 9. So if you want to turn, and again, I read from the NIV, so if that's a distraction, maybe you want to just listen. But if you want to follow along, I always love for you to actually be looking in your own Bibles. So it's 2 Samuel 9. And so this is after David has now, you know, assumed the position of king. And it says, David asked, is there anyone still left in the house of Saul to whom I can show kindness for Jonathan's sake? And I thought, how interesting, kindness. Now all of these words jump out at me. You know, we just looked at that. Now there was a servant of Saul's household named Ziba. They called him to appear before David, and the king said to him, are you Ziba? Your servant, he replied. The king asked, is there no one still left of the house of Saul to whom I can show God's kindness? Ziba answered the king, there is still a son of Jonathan. He is crippled in both feet. Verse 4, where is he? The king asked. Ziba answered, he is at the house of Maker, son of Amiel, in Lo-debar. So King David had him brought from Lo-debar, from the house of Maker, son of Amiel. When Mephibosheth, son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, came to David, he bowed down to pay him honor. David said, "Mephibosheth." "Your servant," he replied. "Don't be afraid," David said to him, "for I will surely show you kindness for the sake of your father Jonathan. I will restore you to you all the land that belonged to your grandfather Saul, and you will always eat at my table." Now keep in mind, if you picked it up, you know that Mephibosheth wasn't even living on the property. He didn't even have his own home. He was living in somebody else's house, miles away. And so I think that's why when he was summoned to come speak to the king, he came in trepidation, thinking, "Oh no, I'm from the family of Saul. What might this mean for me?" And David says, "You know, no reason to be afraid." You know, and he explains that he wants to restore everything to him that had been lost to him. Verse 8, Mephibosheth bowed down and said, "What is your servant that you should notice a dead dog like me?" Then the king summoned Ziba, Saul's servant, and said to him, "I've given your master's grandson everything that belonged to Saul and his family. You and your sons and your servants are to farm the land for him and bring in the crops so that your master's grandson may be provided for. And Mephibosheth, grandson of your master, will always eat at my table." Then it has some parentheses. "Now Ziba had 15 sons and 20 servants. Verse 11, then Ziba said to the king, "Your servant will do whatever my lord the king commands his servant to do." So Mephibosheth ate at David's table like one of the king's sons. Mephibosheth had a young son named Micah, and all the members of Ziba's household were servants of Mephibosheth. And Mephibosheth lived in Jerusalem because he always ate at the king's table. And he was crippled in both feet. Isn't that an interesting story? You know, you see David seeking out Mephibosheth and then restoring to him everything that he had given up, that he considered lost to him forever. And did you pick up on the fact that here, as I say, he's living miles away in a home that isn't his? Apparently he's married, has a son. You know, he's an adult, of course, at this point. But Ziba does still live on the king's estate. And it says that he had 15 sons and 20 servants. That in itself paints kind of a picture, doesn't it, of how established he was, of maybe the way he was viewed in the king's household. And yet here, he steps out of the room, comes back in, and in that moment's time, everything has been tipped upside down in Ziba's world. Because suddenly he is told that he and his sons are going to be underlings, essentially, of Mephibosheth. That they are to serve him. They are to work his property, serving him, all of his 15 sons and 20 servants. If you think about that, you can immediately just kind of picture what that might do to a person who was like Ziba. So then, and yet it seems that Ziba accepts it, you know, because he says, "Your servant will do whatever my lord the king commands his servant to do." So he makes the right sounds with his mouth. Fast forward to the rebellion of David's son, Absalom. And again, I'm counting on you knowing these stories. But He rebels against the king. He wants to be king. David feels that the hearts of all the men are with Absalom because he had an incredible personality and was able to just make everybody feel important, make everybody feel cared about. He came up, you know, knew how to project this very sincere, caring, benevolent image. And David felt, oh, all the hearts are with him. So when Absalom was revolting and wanting to take over the kingship, David felt his life was in jeopardy, and so felt that he and his household had to flee from Jerusalem. So we pick up on the rest of that story in 2 Samuel 16, again, if you want to turn there. And I'm going to read, just in case you just make reference, I'm going to read from verse 1 through 4. When David had gone a short distance beyond the summit, there was Ziba, the steward of Mephibosheth, waiting to meet him. He had a string of donkeys saddled and loaded with 200 loaves of bread, 100 cakes of raisins, 100 cakes of figs, and a skin of wine. The king asked Ziba, "Why have you brought these?" Ziba answered, "The donkeys are for the king's household to ride on. The bread and fruit are for the men to eat, and the wine is to refresh those who become exhausted in the desert." I mean, doesn't all of that sound so thoughtful? Verse 3, the king then asked, "Where is your master's grandson?" Ziba said to him, "He's staying in Jerusalem because he thinks, 'Today the house of Israel will give me back my grandfather's kingdom.'" Then the king said to Ziba, "All that belonged to Mephibosheth is now yours." "I humbly bow," Ziba said. "May I find favor in your eyes, my lord the king." Humbly bow. Yeah, right. I mean, don't you really see, even if you didn't know the rest of the story, just what you've already known about Mephibosheth, doesn't something not ring true here? So again, fast forward. Absalom is killed in the battle. The kingdom is restored to David. So now David heads back to Jerusalem. You can turn to 2 Samuel 19. And I'm going to read to you from verses 24 to 30. Mephibosheth, Saul's grandson, also went down to meet the king. So this is as he's coming back now into Jerusalem. He had not taken care of his feet or trimmed his mustache or washed his clothes from the day the king left until the day the king returned to safety. When he came from Jerusalem to meet the king asked him, "Why didn't you go with me, Mephibosheth?" Verse 26, he said, "My lord the king, since I, your servant, am lame, I said, 'I will have my donkey saddled and will ride on it so I can go with the king.' But Ziba, my servant, betrayed me." Now, I'm not sure because it doesn't quite say, but maybe he took his donkey. Remember, he came with a string of donkeys. Maybe he took Mephibosheth's donkey because he couldn't have walked there on his own. But all he knew is that Ziba had a hand in it, and it was betrayal on his part. Verse 27, "And he slandered your servant to my lord the king. My lord the king is like an angel of God. So do whatever pleases you. All my grandfather's descendants deserve nothing but death from my lord the king. But you gave your servant a place among those who sat at your table. So what right do I have to make any more appeals to the king?" The king said to him, "Why say more? I order you and Ziba, to defy the fields. Mephibosheth said to the king, "Let him take everything, now that my lord the king has arrived home safely." I love that. You know, Mephibosheth, let him take everything. See, if you're an envious person, you're never going to have enough. You're always going to want something more, something else, something new. And Tad isn't an envious person, but I remember when computers first came out and people were getting them for themselves, you know, and Tad had made the decision, okay, I'm going to do this. I'm going to buy a computer. And he started really researching. And the more he researched, the worse it got. And he said, "I know this sounds stupid, Mom." You know, Mom who knew nothing about computers. He said, "I know this sounds stupid, Mom, but the part that gets me now is I know the minute I go in and purchase a computer, by the time I'm out of the store, it will have been upgraded somehow. They're going to have come up with something else." He said, that's how fast this technology is working. And truly, that is how an envious person lives. Whatever they have, it kills them that there might be something better or something more. They're never content with what they have. But if you're a person who chooses to be content, your perspective is totally different. I mean, Mephibosheth was apparently content living miles away, living in someone else's home, no possessions of his own. He was apparently content. He's brought into the king's house, sitting at the king's table. He's blessed beyond belief. But he has a very light hold of it. And when he has reason to believe it's all been taken from him, as I'm sure Ziba loved telling him, it's so be it. But when he hears that the king comes back and that he is safe, he goes to meet him and then basically says to him, you know, all I care about is that you're here, you're safe, you do whatever you want. Let Ziba have it all. You know what I find interesting? You couldn't take Mephibosheth's contentment away from him. Yeah, what about Ziba? Do you think no matter what he got, he was ever content? And my guess is that Ziba was essentially miserable from the time that Mephibosheth entered the scene. I don't know what the Lord might have for any here this morning, but there might be some little something there. And always it's my prayer that the Lord gives you ears to hear it. Because I do know clearly, I would no more have thought of that story than anything. So I believe the Lord gave it to me with specific reason. The next story that we're going to look at is the story of Miriam, Aaron, and Moses. And that's found in Numbers 12, if you want to turn there. And again, I just have to read this to you. Verse 1, Miriam and Aaron began to talk against Moses because of his Cushite wife, for he married a Cushite. "Has the Lord spoken only through Moses?" they asked. "Hasn't he also spoken through us?" And the Lord heard this. Now Moses was a very humble man, more humble than anyone else on the face of the earth. I don't know if that's in parentheses in your Bible, but it is in mine. It's like this little comment interjected. Verse 4. At once the Lord said to Moses, Aaron, and Miriam, come out to see to the tent of meeting, all three of you. So the three of them came out. Then the Lord came down in a pillar of cloud. He stood at the entrance of the tent and summoned Aaron and Miriam. When both of them stepped forward, he said, listen to my words. When a prophet of the Lord is among you, I reveal myself to him in visions. I speak to him in dreams. But this is not true of my servant Moses. He is faithful in all my house. With him, I speak face to face, clearly, not in riddles. He sees the form of the Lord. Why then were you not afraid to speak against my servant Moses? Verse 9, the anger of the Lord burned against them and he left them. When the cloud lifted from above the tent, there stood Miriam, leprous like snow. Aaron turned toward her and saw that she had leprosy. And he said to Moses, please, my Lord, do not hold against us the sin we have so foolishly committed. Do not let her be like a stillborn infant coming from its mother's womb with its flesh half eaten away. So Moses cried out to the Lord, O God, please heal her. The Lord replied to Moses, if her father had spit in her face, would she not have been in disgrace for 7 days? Confine her outside the camp for 7 days. After that, she can be brought back. So Miriam was confined outside the camp for 7 days, and the people did not move on till she was brought back. After that, the people left Hazeroth and encamped in the desert of Paran. You know, in some ways you could look at the story and think, whew, sibling rivalry, big time. And we do see sibling rivalry throughout the word, don't we? I mean, we see it with Joseph and his brothers, with Rachel and Leah, Mary and Martha. I mean, we see it a lot. So why should we be surprised when we see it in our own homes with our kids? And in this story, we see Miriam and Aaron, and they're challenging the authority and the position of Moses. And because Miriam's name is mentioned first, that might indicate that she was the one who started the whole quarrel. And I thought, actually, her statement also sounds like, you know, I can hear the same tone that a sister would say, why does he always get to sit in the front seat? You know, if you have multiple kids, you've probably heard that refrain yourself. But Miriam is upset because Moses has power. Moses has authority. And you have to remember, Moses was the younger brother. Aaron and Miriam were older. So in a way, I think I can get that a little bit, except for the fact that they had seen over and over again situations where it was obviously God who had put Moses in that position. He hadn't stepped up to it himself. He hadn't claimed it, you know, said, I get it first, you know. It was God-given, and they had seen situation after situation after situation of miracles, of God just listening to Moses and acting on his behalf. So the point is, they were without this. They still came to the conclusion that somehow Moses was, you know, hogging God's favor. You know, that they should be able to do it too. And yet to remember that both Aaron and Miriam had their own positions. They had authority. Miriam was a prophetess, we read. Aaron was what? He was a high priest. So it's not as if they didn't have position, but again, see, wasn't enough. Someone was over them. And do you know in life that that can be a real issue for some people? How many people have you heard say, well, I have my own business because I couldn't stand to work under somebody, you know? And it's a reality, you know? If you work under someone, you have to subject yourself to that authority. And the thing I'm always hoping women will realize is that when you subject yourselves to your husband, it actually feels really good once you start doing it and experiencing the blessing God intends it to be. But the enemy, again, will always want you to feel that it's a lesser than position, that the authority of the husband over the wife is this kind. And you will not see that anywhere in the Word. But again, that's just what the enemy loves to do, to get us striving. You know, even the disciples strived, didn't they, over position. You know, who was going to sit to the right, to the left of Jesus? You know, I mean, if even in the disciples. So the point is, it's a sin that is common to man. And what we have to see clearly is that it's more than just something that goes with our flesh. We need to name it for what it is, which is sin. And again, to give it no room in our lives. The part that really got me was when Miriam complains and said, has the Lord only spoken through Moses? Hasn't he also spoken through us? And the very next sentence is, and the Lord heard it. And I wonder if we actively keep in our minds that God hears our conversations. He hears the words that come out of our mouths. He hears our thoughts. And I was so glad when Ted mentioned that last night about, you know, praying. If you're afraid of people seeing you in the next car, you know, and you're praying out loud to God, and they'll think you're crazy or something. And he says, it's okay, because God hears your thoughts too. But he does. He knows our thoughts as well. And I think sometimes, you know, we love to remember that when we're praying, when we're having time with the Lord, when we're asking for him to help in a situation, to bless, to heal, to deliver. We love that knowledge that what we're saying, he hears. And then we walk away from the prayer time and we start having bad thoughts, or we have a conversation with someone that's kind of mean, or we're quick. What happens to our thinking then, that we aren't remembering that God hears? And I think especially for women who really have trouble with a cutting tongue, with sarcasm, with gossip, if we would only keep on the front of our brains, God hears, it would help us to do a lot less of it. Psalm 94, it says, does he who implanted the ear not hear? Does he who formed the eye not see? The Lord knows the thoughts of man, and he knows that they are futile. Now getting back to that little parenthetical statement, you know, where it said that, where am I back here? Verse 3, now Moses was a very humble man, more humble than anyone else on the face of the earth. When I read that, I mean, and maybe when you did too, don't you think, I mean, it doesn't seem to follow in the story, and you wonder, here's Aaron and Miriam, and now it makes this little statement about Moses. I think the reason, and it's just my guess, is that even though we don't see it, Moses is in that picture. And Moses hears the statement and says what? Nothing. He has no need to defend himself. And that is true humility. And I think that's why we see it there. I love the fact that he doesn't need to defend himself, that he entrusted himself to the Lord. And the minute I thought that, I thought of the verse in 1 Peter 2:23, where Peter speaks of Jesus saying, when they hurled their insults at him, he did not retaliate. When he suffered, he made no threats. Instead, he entrusted himself to him who judges justly. And again, that might be a word for someone here today, a woman who is being criticized, accused, insulted. You know, we can feel such a need to defend ourselves, to make it right, to explain. Now, learn this lesson. You don't need to defend yourself. You don't need to explain to anybody anything. God hears, and he will take up your cause, even as he did here. So essentially, the Lord called the three of them to come before him. And God not only defended, but commended Moses, didn't he? And he corrected Miriam and Aaron. And it says that after he corrected them, the anger of the Lord burned against them, and he left them. And to me, that says he did not wait to listen to their lame excuses. When the cloud lifted, he was gone. But when the cloud lifted, what did they see? Miriam had leprosy. So that was her consequence. And what was Aaron's response? He looks at it, he turns to Moses. Turns to Moses. Who does he see Moses as now? Suddenly he's, okay, Moses, you know, please. So he pleads to Moses that this not happen to Miriam. And Moses pleads on her behalf to God. And God listens, and God honors the prayer. And again, that made me think of Jesus too, because here Moses is pleading on behalf of the very people who moments before were being so cruel, so unkind. And now, that's the story we see with Jesus on the cross. Father, forgive them. Praying for the very people who had put him there. I've never actually seen leprosy. Maybe I would assume none of us have, because now they're able to treat it. But I've talked to old-time missionaries who told me about the leper colonies that they had in other countries and how awful a thing leprosy is. They told me that the skin literally rots, that there is an unbelievable stench that absolutely makes you want to get sick. And I think the Lord was giving Miriam a picture of how he sees envy. And he was showing her that there are definite similarities. It's rotten. It has a stench in God's nostrils. Eats a person, and it separates a person from the others. God hates it. And he gave her 7 days to think about that. In James 3:13-14, it says, "Who is wise and understanding among you? Let him show by good conduct that his works are done in the meekness of wisdom. But if you have bitter envy and selfish ambition in your hearts, do not boast about it or deny the truth. For where envy and self-seeking exist, confusion and every evil thing are there." The third story we're going to look at is a story that is an interesting comparison between two women, one who is envious and one who is not, and yet both seemingly wanting the same thing. And the example of this story starts in the Old Testament, but it covers a lot of ground, so I'm not even going there. I'm just going to basically tell you. But I'll give you the addresses so that you can read it if you're not familiar with it. It's Genesis 29 through Genesis 35. And it's the story of Leah and Rachel. They're two sisters. Leah is the older sister, who is apparently not particularly attractive. And Rachel, the younger sister, who we're told was beautiful. Jacob fell in love with Rachel, and their love story is not without a lot of problems. But the rivalry that we see develop between the two sisters is absolutely mind-boggling. And the core of their problem is envy. And I have wondered, even though we don't read it, I wondered if, just knowing the importance women put on physical looks, you know, beauty, I wonder if even back from childhood, Leah might have been envious of Rachel, her younger and prettier sister. You know, very possible. Then Jacob comes on the scene, and through trickery, marries Rachel, the trickery of her father. Marries Leah, the trickery of her father. And I thought, even that would be like a wound, because it would be like confirming that even Dad thinks I'm so ugly that I wouldn't get a husband on my own, you know? It had to be through deception. I mean, wouldn't that seem that way when he set up the circumstances the way he did? And again, if you don't know the story, you need to read it, because it's pretty amazing. But I wondered, you know, so was this maybe a rivalry that on Leah's part that might have started in their childhood? Eventually, Jacob marries Rachel too, and it starts. Leah has no difficulty conceiving, and boom, 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 four sons, one right after the other. Rachel, none. And you have to wonder, you know, again, your picture, because again, in that time, the emphasis on having children was huge. If a woman was barren, it was terrible. And so can you picture Leah each time she has a son? You know, do you think she kind of gloried in it a little bit? I think she did, because the description of her and her response to each son definitely shows she's glorying in it. And in the meantime, Rachel's getting the message. She's seeing this. She's wanting it for herself. And the other thing I feel with poor Leah, you know, she may have been glorying in this, but the other thing that she was trying to compensate for was what? Not only was Rachel prettier, but Rachel was the one who had Jacob's devotion, his heart. So on every level for Leah, you know. And so I can see her doing this, trying to win that love. as well as to Rachel, you know. In Genesis 30, it says, when Rachel saw that she bore Jacob no children, Rachel envied her sister. And I thought, wow, that might have been a first. That might have been a first. Imagine the beautiful sister envying the not-so-pretty sister. Rachel said to Jacob, give me children or else I die. Notice, she's not just heartbroken because she longs so much for a baby. She sees the number her sister has. And she doesn't say, I want a baby, give me a baby. And any woman here who's been there knows that can be a real heartache when you want a baby. But to me, the envy here is seen, reveals itself, exposed. When she says, give me children or I'll die. So with all of that, that was just a backdrop, because the two women I'm wanting to compare are not Leah and Rachel. The woman I'm wanting to compare them to is another woman we read about in the Old Testament. And her name is Hannah. And she's found in 1 Samuel, in the first chapter. And again, I'm just hoping you know this story, because we don't have time to read it. We're already over, but that's okay. Again, it's the story of a man, Elkanah, who has two wives. That seems to always be a problem, doesn't it? He has two wives. One is, well, her name is, I think, supposed to be pronounced Peninnah, but I always call her Peninnah. Because then to me that says what she's like, you know. So there was Peninnah and Hannah. And similar to Leah and Rachel, Peninnah was not the favored one, but she was the one with children. And Hannah was the one who did not have them. But Elkanah was devoted to Hannah. And he was okay that she didn't have children. In fact, he tried to love her so much that he'd make up for the fact that she didn't have children. It says that he said to her, you know, why are you so sad? Aren't I worth more than 10 sons to you? And that would be like, in that time, the proverbial, incredible, perfect family, you know, 10 sons. And he's saying, you know, aren't I better than that to you? That's how much he loved her and tried to make her happy. But we realize that Peninnah was envious of that love. And she tried to make Hannah's life miserable. It says in the Bible that she provoked her severely. And yet the amazing thing is Hannah does not take that bait. Never shows her retaliating. Never shows her saying anything. Just shows her heart is broken. It shows that she is miserable. But does she make demands of Elkanah? Nothing that we read. Who did she talk to about it? It says Hannah wept before the Lord. She poured out her heart to him. And I find it interesting that Rachel insisted on Jacob giving her children. And she died in the birth of her second child. Hannah? Hannah asked for one. God gave her one, plus four more. That's kind of interesting. So we can see Rachel as peevish and pouting. But in Hannah, we see a woman who is devoted to the Lord, and she pours out her heart to him in prayer. She's not demanding, is she? She's submissive. She says to the Lord, "If you will only look upon your servant's misery and remember me, and not forget your servant, but give her a son, then I will give him to the Lord for all the days of his life." She sees herself as the Lord's servant, and her request is made in submission. The contrast of these women, and we can consider all four of them, Leah, Rachel, Peninnah, and Hannah. There's only one in whom we don't see the evidence of envy. Hannah alone shines out to us as an example, and I love that. While Peninnah hurt her deeply, she never retaliated, never complained to Elkanah, never made demands on him. But she wept before the Lord, pouring out her heart to him and trusting him for the outcome. Hannah's example shows us what we're to do with our heart's longings. We're not to complain to those around us, demand to others to satisfy that longing we have. They may or may not be even able to do it. But when we have a longing in our heart, and again, truly, when we're talking about wanting a baby, that is the longing. I've talked to loads of women who have longed for that. And sometimes the Lord has granted them a baby from their own womb. Sometimes they have adopted. Sometimes they have waited. Some of you may be waiting. That longing is a valid one. Please don't think in any way I would ever minimize that. But what I am saying is take that longing to the Lord. The enemy would love you to look at every woman who's pregnant and be hurt by it, to be wounded by it, to be thinking, "God, you're making a mistake here. She already has one. She already has three. What's that about? All I'm wanting, God, is one." Come to the Lord, pour out your heart, but know that he hears you and he cares, and choose, it's a mental decision, choose to trust what he does with that. And know he wants to comfort your heart, but don't give the enemy that room that you resent someone else's blessing. You're envious of them. It makes you mad at them. Think about envy. There's nothing loving about it. If you're envying somebody, I'll tell you right now, you're not loving them. You might even think they're your good friend and you do love them, except for this one thing. No. If you are envying a friend, you are not loving them. So see envy for what it is. And when it comes to envy, give yourselves absolutely no slack, none. The minute you feel it in your heart, recognize that's not you. You don't have to go, "Woe is me." It's the temptation from the enemy. Recognize and say, "Nope, God, I'm not going there. I'm not going there. Bless her, bless them, whatever you need to do. I'm so happy to see the promotion he got. That is so great. They got a new car. Wow, their home is amazing, Lord." You know, whatever. But I am not going to harbor envy, because, God, you hate it. It's like leprosy. It's rotten. It stinks. Now help me to go on, because God will. every single time. So the big thing is to see clearly that it is sin, but then to remember why the enemy loves to use it. And that's because the last thing he wants you to experience is the sweetness of being content. To be content is a wonderful thing. It's a gift that the Lord has for every single one of us. And it has nothing to do with what we own, with what we have, with how we look. It has nothing to do with that. It's finding our contentment in him. And that is a gift he has for every single woman here, no matter what is happening. Don't let the enemy steal that from you today. In 1 Timothy 6:6-8, it says, "But godliness with contentment is great gain, for we brought nothing into the world, and we can take nothing out of it. But if we have food and clothing, we'll be content with that." My prayer is that is a truth that we would all know, that we would all live, and that people would say it is true of us. Let's pray. Father, I thank you so much because, God, I know that you are taking us through this chapter, showing us those things that love is and the things that love is not. And Father, you know the things you have spoken to my sisters today. And my prayer is that we would take hold of them. We would talk to you about them. That we would not give the enemy permission to steal the gift of contentment you have for each one of us. Have your way in our lives, Lord. We'll pray that every day. Your way, your will. Lord, we want to love. We want your love to love through us. Help us to get out of the way. In Jesus' name, amen. Now, I know I'm late, so you're just going to have time today to rush to your groups and just share prayer requests. You won't have questions today. You're just going to share prayer requests and pray for each other, which is such an important part of this meeting every week. God bless you.